The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. Well, we are... Did I tell you their phone number? No, I got distracted thanking Carter. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return to the February 2021 edition of Our State Celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month has been Made in North Carolina. We've done most of those articles so far. And now we are going to go to... This being the last reading of the month, we're going to go to the back of the magazine for the feature that's been going on for a number of years, about the decades, various decades. I think, as I recall, we started in the 40s. We did the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and we are now at the 70s, the decade of disruption, which is interesting because now in 2020s, they're talking about disruption again in terms of a technical companies doing disruption to other companies. But that's not what we're talking about back here. We're talking about the Vietnam War, I'm quite sure. A leader for peace. As the Vietnam War roils campuses across the country, students at North Carolina State University seek peace, unity, and answers to difficult questions. Written by Philip Gerard. I look at this double spread here of a thousand students or whatever, definitely hundreds of them, sitting out on the lawn in front of some NC State universities. And wonder how many people know that their college pictures are here in this big double spread, because these people are very distinguishable here in their youth. And now they'd be pretty much my age, which is going to be in the 70s, I guess. So it would be really interesting if they knew. You know, there's certainly 20 people here easily are recognizable here. And it'd be interesting to know if they know they're here. The caption to the photo says, on May 8, 1970, 4,500 college students from across North Carolina gathered in NC State's Brickyard before marching on the state capitol in protest of the Kent State shootings and the invasion of Cambodia. On a warm spring day in 1970, on the campus of Kent State University, about 100 members of the Ohio National Guard faced down a noonday student protest against the Vietnam War and President Richard Nixon's recent invasion of Cambodia. For reasons that will be litigated for years to come, 28 of them turn and fire on the protesters with live rounds, more than 60 shots in a period of just 13 seconds. Four students fall dead, and another nine are wounded. The shootings reverberate onto the campus of North Carolina State University, more than 500 miles away, in the middle of a spirited campaign for student body president. On May 5th, the day after the shootings, the student newspaper, The Technician, announces that State has elected its first female student body president, Kathy Sterling. Sterling began her college career as a singer on a music scholarship at UNC Chapel Hill, but after a turbulent year is transferred to State. She lives off campus with her boyfriend, Gene Messick, a young instructor in the School of Design, and is now pursuing a degree in Industrial Cooperative Training, ICT. She's one of only a small number of women on campus. It was not uncommon that I was in class where I was the only girl in the room surrounded by guys, she says, and it turned them to regular goofballs, I have to say. She has to run on a platform to abolish what she considers exorbitant non-academic fees. Her in-state tuition is $225 per year, but non-academic fees of $196 nearly double the cost. I had started writing letters to the technician about the athletic fee, which really stirred a pot, she later recalled. Now Sterling finds herself in a movement of national upheaval. Across the country, campuses are erupting in outage. What will happen at NCSU, a campus that has been politically quiet, affectionately known to students as Cow College? The serving president vacates immediately, offering no help to Sterling in making the transition. I cannot begin to tell you how hard that was for me, she remembers. To cope, I just let go of all academic work with the reluctant approval of my teachers, taking incompletes in all my subjects. Just one day after her election, Sterling addresses a hastily convened convocation of almost 2,000 students, faculty, and staff at the Brickyard, a traditional campus gathering spot. As student body president-elect of North Carolina State University, I urge that all students on this campus carefully and morally consider and assess the events of the past week, she says. Whether you were angry or satisfied, let it be known, but in the most peaceful, most constructive way possible. Hate will never be a cure for hate. It will never win a war. Chancellor John T. Caldwell joins the other five UNC system chancellors and President William Friday in a statement to Senators Sam Ervin and B. Everett Jordan, urging an end to the war in Southeast Asia. The error of Vietnam has poisoned the nation, and now it has wounded it in one more grievous way. The war has wounded our universities. On May 8th, Sterling leads some 6,000 peace marchers to the state capitol, where she and student leaders from other universities present to Governor Bob Scott a written denunciation of his telegram to Nixon in support of the incursion into Cambodia. Tipped off that police are going to arrest Sterling for cohabitation, illegal under state law, she and Messick arrange a quick wedding near Asheboro. Some people just really had demonized me, saying I was a student radical, and I wasn't, she says. I was just mushy soft, you know? For the nights that I came off strong in the day, I'd go home and I'd say to myself, crying, was I too mean to the chancellor? While campuses across the nation are shuttered by student strikes or violent protests, Sterling leads her constituents down a different path. She and a cohort of activists, including Jean Dees, a Vietnam veteran, organize a peace retreat. They plan to enlist faculty and administrators to use the end of the semester for a program of educational dialogue seeking solutions and common ground. First, at my core, I have always been a very peaceful person, she writes. Conflict has never been my path. She discounts her own role, though clearly she is the one they are all following. It was not just me. So many things that I got credit for were not just me, and they weren't even my bright idea necessarily, she says. They were really born out of collaboration with a lot of others. The official chair is Dees, who writes in the movement's policy statement, "The idea that the peace retreat is a leftist movement is false. Its chairman, myself, is an ex-Green Beret sergeant that supports the president's move into Cambodia and plans to return to the army after graduation. Gentlemen, I am by no means left." The peace retreat really wasn't about closing down the university. It wasn't like going on strike. That wasn't anybody's interest here, Sterling explains. It was certainly felt by many people that the university needed to address what was going on in the nation and look at the issues. So how do we do that in a way that's going to be the most productive? A genuine examination and talking things out where people of all persuasions could come together and do that. She works closely with Chancellor Caldwell and recalls him with fondness. Dr. Caldwell was a superb specimen of a very chivalrous Southern gentleman, gracious in presentation, steel-like in behavior. He basically tolerated me, treating me with a kind indulgence, fatherly, never unkind in word or action. Caldwell presents options for grading so that students won't be penalized for participating in peace retreat forums instead of attending regular exam sessions. Sternly explains that professors could say, well, before you leave, you've got to give me a paper, or you've got to come to my office and tell me what you have learned, that you're not just spending this time playing frisbee out in the brickyard. Five service groups handled the logistics of organizing the retreat, from labor to public relations, while 20 community action groups work on issues ranging from fundraising and canvassing for peace to Black Action, a blood drive, a free press, and opposition to the draft. The May 13 seminars address the Vietnam War from perspectives including historical aspects of the U.S. entry into Southeast Asia and ecology effects of the Indo-Chinese War upon the terrain of Southeast Asia. The following day features sessions on the moral, religious, and ethical effects of the war and the toll of the fighting on the Vietnamese people and Black Americans. The peace retreat is a signature achievement, noticeable, or rather notable, for its constructive nature and its complete lack of violence. Any member of the state community could engage with any other consenting member to express strongly heartfelt positions, Sterling writes. Before her presidency expires in 1971, she gets a chance to address student fees, the issue she campaigned on. But the administration can be stubborn and resistant to change. I often wondered if the personal cost to me had ever mattered, she later writes. Did the events of spring 70 or the following 18 months of my service have any true lasting value in the history of state? As a deeply principled leader, she has indeed achieved something great of great value. The student voice has been heard, and the threat of violence has given way to passionate but peaceful debate. Coming next month, racial tensions flare in Wilmington. You're listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. Comments, questions, 919-781-1973. And now, the Ramblin' Man, T. Edward Nickens, writes The Dreams That Linger. A century has passed since Latta University closed its doors, and generations have come and gone from the Raleigh neighborhood where it once stood. In North Carolina, history is all around us, even with the evidence of the past has all but vanished. The tree is still a story, part of the story at least. These are soaring old oak trees with full 360-degree crowns. I've written about homestead oaks before, those sentinel trees that once flourished in the full sun of a farmhouse yard or a field corner, only to be crowded by younger trees that grow up in the surrounding forest. But I never thought of a homestead oak in the city, much less a few blocks from my backyard. Look at those old soldiers, I said to my wife, Julie, as we walked past a giant vacant lot not far from our house. We have several four-mile walking routes through the neighborhoods near downtown Raleigh, and by now I would have thought I'd seen every acorn and shrub along the various ways. Holy cow, something big must have been there. That's where the Latta House stood, Julie said, pulling our dog Minnie away from some particularly interesting scent on the asphalt. The old African-American school had closed down. You don't know about this? I pursed my lips and tried to appear reflective. Sadly for me, Julie knows, clueless when she sees it. You need to get out more. We never broke stride. Mile after mile, Julie never breaks stride. But I kept looking back at the vacant lot, a morose stretch of land that seemed to have something to say. That's when I noticed a historic site marker that read, Latta House and University Site, CA 1892 to 1930. When I got back home, only six blocks away, I called up Mr. Google to see what he might know about that vacant lot. And Julie was right. I do need to pay closer attention. The Reverend Morgan London Latta was born into slavery in 1853 on a plantation in Durham County. After the Civil War, he attended Shaw University and around 1890 moved with his wife to Raleigh. They had 60 cents between them. Latta worked as a schoolteacher, and in 1892 he established Latta University on these few rolling acres. By then, formerly enslaved people from across the region had streamed into Oberlin Village, one of 13 freedmen's communities developed in and around Raleigh. At Latta University, tuition, room, and board cost male students $6.75 a month, and female students a dollar less. Not all could pay. Some worked on the school's farm or as carpenters and construction workers on campus. At its peak, Latta University sprawled across nearly 300 acres and had 23 buildings, including two three-and-a-half-story dormitories. How could I have not known about this? I've lived six blocks away for 23 years. We've walked around this neighborhood for nearly 30 years. But we rarely see the things we aren't looking for. Julie and I walk this neighborhood for miles at a time, and on most of those jaunts, we're simply passing through. Julie, looking to see who has the best-looking flower beds. I'm eyeing every squirrel so we can brace for Minnie's bristle-backed lunge. We make grocery lists, check off to-do lists, plan for upcoming holidays, muse about dreams for the future. Step by step and mile after mile, we walk and walk and walk, barely mindful that the rolling hills around our home have heard it all before. Talk, plans, and no shortage of dreams. Latta University shut down around 1920. Land was sold, and Latta and his wife moved to Philadelphia. He passed away there sometime between 1935 and 1945. The last structure standing was the Latta's Queen Anne home, which burned and was bulldozed in 2007. Six blocks from where I lay my head. I hadn't heard about that either. Practically nothing remains. Thankfully, the city of Raleigh is working to preserve the physical remnants of Reverend Latta's dream. Part of the plan is to create some sort of physical outline of the old Latta house with benches and a few interpretive signs. The challenge is that there's a lamentably meager collection of artifacts from the school. A small archaeological dig done on the site unearthed a few signposts of the past, fragments of plates and a shoe polish bottle. A knife handle, two horseshoes, indicative perhaps of the university's blacksmith shop. And Reverend Latta left behind a 370-page autobiography, The History of My Life and Work, published in 1903 as part of his wide-ranging efforts to raise funds for the school. It's part of UNC Chapel Hill's Documenting the American South Digitization Project. You can find it online in less time than it takes to order light bulbs. Latta lived an unembellished life, and the history of my life and work is as heartbreaking as it is uplifting. I've always desired from my youth, he wrote, to do something worthy of speaking of, and that would be a light to the race that I'm identified with. I've walked past the old Latta University site many times in the months since my discovery, and I keep my head up when we turn down that block. No matter where we live, we too easily forget that we live among ghosts, and we walk in the footprints of those who toiled and played and made their homes and their lives on the very ground we make ours. I look up in the trees, and I tell myself that I can still make out the hazy outlines of their hopes and dreams and plans, caught up in hoary branches like grasping vines, still reaching for the things that are worth reaching for. Well, you're listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. And this article is entitled From the Heart. To many, Valentine's Day is about romantic partners exchanging cards and candy. But the true essence of the holiday is love in every form. Written by Susan Stafford Kelly. I have a friend with a passion for lip-smacking symbols and everything. Her stationery, beach towels, cocktail napkins, socks. For her, Valentine's Day is all day every day. Maybe not so for everyone, but February 14th is still special. For most people, Valentine's Day is more of a, shall we say, frolicsome, lighthearted holiday. While its ancient roots herald the arrival of spring, we know better. Valentine's Day exists to get us through winter's final, grimmest grip. Every February, 145 million Valentine's Day cards are mailed in the United States. But this figure doesn't include all those sent, sans stamp, by millions of school children to thousands of classroom Valentine folders and boxes. Every February, my mother bought red and pink construction paper and a package of doilies. She showed me how to fold a piece of paper and cut an elongated half moon, then open it, creating a perfect heart shape, too fragile to hold a shape. The doilies were pasted carefully, or the glue would clog the delicate open work, on top of a larger scissored heart. My homemade Valentines naturally had no envelopes, and I crayoned your basic two from Happy Valentine's Day message with the middle heart. How I longed for store-bought Valentines with snappy slogans and recognizable characters like Mickey Mouse or Yogi Bear, and how rueful I am now at my crass preference for the commercial over the creative. Valentine's Day is my mother's favorite holiday. She's 91, but there's never been a February 14 that a Whitman's sampler hasn't appeared at our doorstep. The yellow box with a stiff cardboard rim and layer of that padded precursor to bubble wrap inside that is simultaneously crunchy and soft. I probably learned how to read the key on a Whitland sampler lid, messenger boy, molasses chew, before I could read a North Carolina map key, railroad tracks, lighthouse, airport, and learned as well to leave the cherry cordial for some other sucker. Heck, that must be me, because I thought she was going to say leave it to last. And what an improvement over chalky conversation hearts. The Valentine's Day equivalent of Halloween's orange marshmallow peanuts. Red hots were much easier to fit inside an envelope of your elementary school Valentine's and didn't carry the concern or a message that might be taken too seriously. Let's kiss. Hot stuff. After childhood, Valentine's Day wades into the paradise or swamp of romance. Boyfriends, girlfriends, sweethearts, secret admirers, roses, candles, diamonds, dinners, the stuff of attraction, the symbols for passion. But any casual browse through a greeting card rack will reinforce what you already know, that Valentine's isn't just for lovers, but also for grandparents and siblings and best friends and man's best friend. Because love is a too wide-ranging, impossible-to-pin-down gamut of feelings to be limited to mere romance. Love is appreciation for the walker who stops to help you pitch the ropes over a high tree branch, to string up a swing, or always has a treat for the dog. Affection is a form of love, too, for the heavily accented owners of the small bakery who assure you that they'll have the sauerkraut hand pies ready, or the coworker who shares his tech skills. I'd like to send a Valentine of admiration to those who plant the coreopsis and the poppies along highway medians. Can I just send a Valentine to the trees on a curving mountain road in autumn when it's been raining and the yellows of their leaves so stark and bright against the silver wetness of their bare trunks and the green rhododendrons behind them? A Valentine is a Valentine, no matter the feeling or the phrase. I hold dear the way steam rises from a lake at dawn. I'm partial to how a pelican dives, arrow-like and heedless. I have a weakness for the parking lot of Wilbur's Barbecue on any Sunday at lunchtime. I feel affection for ice that freezes in little knife-like shards on plowed field furrows. I fancy the profile trail, the Pisgah Inn, the Rodin sculptures at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and the arched walkway bridge over U.S. Highway 440 as you enter Raleigh. I have a thing for certain boulder the children call the turtle because of the way it juts out at the bend of a road. I'm devoted to the signs for the Eastern Continental Divide that you cross and cross again all over the western part of the state. I'm keen on the cherry cokes at, no, the donuts at, no, the hush puppies at, I feel tenderness for the crescent moon, a curling wave, a shy crocus, and cardinals at my feeder. I am attracted to the Chihuly sculpture in the lobby of the Umstead Hotel and Spa, the Charlotte skyline at night, hunting blinds on stilts in a field raised to the Styx, the walkable docks of Moorhead City. I find irresistible my mother's tiny vanilla-covered ceramic dish shaped like North Carolina with Walnut Cove, her hometown, painted with a star. For a person, place, or thing, with a wish, a prayer, or a homemade valentine. Love is love, and there's surely plenty to go around. Well, in conclusion, I'm going to read a little more from the Made in North Carolina Award runner-ups. Laura Wood Studios in Penland. Double lace earrings. Laura Wood Studios double lace earrings are the product of an unexpected combination, vintage fabrics and industrial materials. Hoping to use ordinary items to find flattering lines, Wood laid out in a 1950s lace collar on a scanner and saved the shapes that came up. She then compiled the best shapes to cut out of metal for the earrings. Though Wood's scanning process was full of trial and error, she ended up finding a perfect design that suited her criteria. Using her lace pattern, she hand cuts all of the earrings from metal, which is then colored with vibrant or neutral tones. I like how jewelry accentuates a person's presentation to the world, Wood says. When I see people actually wearing what I make, they are carrying this piece of my experience into theirs. We will not have time to read the last three of the runner-ups, but I'll mention them. Boxcar Farms in Cedar Grove won a runner-up with their Cotton Bell cheese. You can find them at Boxcar Farms, but there's two R's in farms. Boxcarfarms.com. And Valley Brook Farms in Durham, Fair Game Flying Pepper Mustard. At valleybrookfarmsllc.com. And finally, Sealam Creations in Lumberton, the Pineapple Fire Pit. They're on Facebook as Sealam Creations. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it. You'll be sure to listen to us next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.